Jacob had been wary of being dragged out in public with the parental bodies, wary of a fatherly hand settling on his shoulder while reporters took down remarks like, "Take this hard-working young man. A far better role model for our disadvantaged youth than some benefit scrounger." Nothing of the kind ever came to pass, and the Wallaces had shown such steadfast and enthusiastic support of all things Jacob that he and Jill had had to give in. Before Greg and Petra, none of the people who'd invited Jacob to make himself at home had really meant it. Wanting to mean it didn't count. The Wallaces gave Jacob a front door key, and one day Jill had temporarily confiscated it, just to see how disconsolate Jacob would be at the prospect of a delay in getting home. She'd found that Jacob Nunez, a boy who was usually up for one more three-legged race, one more game of knockdown ginger, one more WWF smackdown, was now very disconsolate indeed at having to endure one more anything before home time. And the Wallaces were so jolly it seemed bad manners not to like them back. Jacob's Labour Party membership probably saddened his parents more than they could say, but you can't have everything. At 12:30, Jill went into the bathroom, found some shampoo, and washed the sweat out of her fringe. She used the hot tap and saw the water steaming, but it splashed her skin blue instead of pink. Never mind, she couldn't feel any of it anyway. She was a bit peckish, though. Gherkins! She'd seen a jar of them in the cupboard when she was putting the shopping away. She fetched them, walking carefully so as not to slip on the water she was dripping. Yay! Gherkins! But she couldn't get the jar open. She heard a voice in the next room, Jacob's again, after she'd told him to leave, and went to have a look. It was only the TV. She surfed channels since it was on. "Remember when almost everybody on TV was older than us, Jacob?" She wrote these things down in her notepad, hurrying because it was almost 12:30. Bedtime. Darkness. Instant and complete. Another head on the pillow beside her. Maybe she grew one more in the night, and that's why the night's sleep was so deep. It was a matching pair of sleeps. A neighbor banged on the door and woke her to complain about wailing coming from her flat. The neighbor was a middle-aged brown man in an unusually close-fitting dressing gown, and she didn't even need to warn him not to try to come in. He stood well away from the front door. He felt the cold. His beard was attractive. It was clear he took good care of it.
"Were you playing some kind of world music? Or do you need an ambulance, or—"
"Or," she told him, "or." And she apologized and promised the noise would stop, though she wasn't sure it actually would. It must have, because she didn't hear from him again. At 12:30, she got up again to go to the toilet. The TV was on again, or still. So she switched it off. She walked past the kitchen and then went back and looked at the kitchen counter. There was the jar of gherkins, where she'd left it. But now the lid was off. Good! She ate a gherkin and checked the room temperature, which had dropped even further. She'd forgotten to find out whether presence was potentially life-threatening. It looked nice outside. She'd go out soon. Maybe at 12:30. Rain fell through sunlight. This was what Sabine Ackerman called fox rain. In her mind's eye, Jill's mother shook iridescent raindrops off her umbrella and said, "Wolves are hosting wedding feasts and witches are brushing their hair today." Presence certainly met its objective, but perhaps the objective itself was flawed and warranted adjustment. Jill wrote that down in her notebook. The next time she went into the kitchen, there was a boy sitting at the table eating toast. 12 years old, maybe 12 and a half. He looked like Jacob, and he looked like Jill. And he had mad scientist hair that looked to be his own invention. She had to quickly pop back to the 15th century to find a word for how beautiful he was. The boy was makeless. From head to toe, he couldn't be equaled. The son she and Jacob hadn't had time to have. Their post-war baby. Having a kid of your own, yes. Now she saw what all the fuss was about. "Thanks for opening the gherkin jar, my strong man," she said, taking his other piece of toast. He could make more. He flexed his puny biceps and said, "You're welcome." He was so new that all his clothes still had price tags attached. They looked the price tags over one by one. "Oh, my God! How much? Thieves and bandits! This isn't even going to fit you 5 minutes from now." Her son rubbed her hands until they were warmer. She liked that. Didn't matter if he was just sucking up in the moments before he asked her for something. He wanted a skateboard, and launched into a list of reasons why she should let him have one, but she just said, "Yes. Stay there." There was a 50-pound note in her purse, and she went to get it. When she came back, he was still there, but a bit older now, about 15 and a half. And he didn't want a skateboard anymore. He wanted some video game console or other. She gave him all the cash she had on her, and told him he'd have to get the rest from his dad. Hugs, kisses, ah, good. They'd raised him to be tactile. "You're the best, Mum." "Yeah, yeah." He dried her sudden tears. "Don't cry while I'm out, Mum." "You're really coming back?" "Yeah, but if you send me away, I won't."
"I'm bloody well not sending you away."
"Great. Bye for now, then." He threw his plate into the sink, more at the sink. No, really, he threw the plate as if it were a frisbee. But it did land in the sink. Sheer luck.
"Hang on, what's your name?"
"Alex, innit?"
"Have you got friends? Who are your friends?"
He rolled his eyes, showed her a few photos on his phone, scrolled past certain other photos at lightning speed. "Mom, it's almost 12:30, so see you later, yeah?" She didn't bother listening for the front door this time. She wanted to say something to her husband about their son. She switched on her laptop and drafted an email to Jacob with the subject line, "Have you seen what we made?" and plugged her headphones in instead of sending it. She played the third conversation they'd filmed, one question and one answer. "What's the hottest time of day?" The answer, known only to them and hundreds of thousands of disciples of a certain K-pop band, was 2 p.m. On screen, Jacob waited for her question. "Hey, Jacob, what's the hottest time of day?" His reply,
"The hottest time of day is 2 p.m.
That niggled at her. Jill frowned. Actually, two things bothered her. His having said, "The hottest time of day is 2 p.m., when the usual answer was simply 2 p.m. And then there was the appearance of Vi's hand in the shot. It was only there for a moment before it was withdrawn from the space in front of the lens with a barely audible oops. But Jill could see now that the waving hand was probably the reason why Jacob laughed a little as he talked his way back toward the answer. Could be that he'd momentarily forgotten a question.
"The hottest time of day is 2 p.m.
Alex returned before she could replay the third conversation again. He was in his early 20s now, and was sporting chin stubble and red chinos. He didn't grumble as much as she'd expected when she made her request that they just watch some telly together. He quite happily complied, putting his arm around the back of the sofa and keeping her warm that way. She didn't have a clue what they were watching, but took the time to absorb every detail of his face, so that later, when he was gone again and it was 12:30 at night, the man who looked like her and Jacob was superimposed on the darkness. In the morning, Alex came back in his late 30s with photos of his wife, Amina, and her granddaughter. Jill went down to the corner shop to try and prepare herself for her son's arrival in her own decade of life. She hadn't looked into the mirror before going out of the front door. Darren at the corner shop was shocked and asked her if she was okay. She told him she was fine and asked about the date and time. It was 4 p.m. in the outside world, and a week and 5 days had passed since she'd begun testing presents. Fox rain was falling, still, and Jill said, "Time flies, time flies." Darren asked her if she was okay again, and this time she asked him how he was. Darren was fine, too, or so he said. "Can't complain." She bought some lip balm and went home. She'd missed Alex's 40s.
"I'm in my 50s now, Mum."
He didn't look it. Maybe he was lying. Maybe your baby's just always your baby. But she didn't feel able to stay at home with her son, who was now older than her. There was a lot she could have learned from him, she knew, but that would have meant staying in that flat, where the temperature was so far below zero that the numbers were now meaningless. She didn't feel able to send Alex away, either. She washed. Not just her fringe. She washed all over, and she took a different outfit out of her suitcase and put it on. She didn't say goodbye to Alex, but left him sleeping on a mattress they'd set up in the second bedroom between the puppet stages, still makeless, though by 12:30 his presence would have faded away altogether. Jill locked the front door behind her and made 2 journeys. First stop, work, to ask after her boys, the one she still had hope for. The front desk warden made a few phone calls in a low voice with her back turned, then told her they were fine. Nothing out of the ordinary had happened, and wasn't it tomorrow that she was due back?
"Good. Yes, that's right. See you tomorrow."
Jill's second journey ended at home in Holland Park. On the train, she thought about the likelihood that Vi would be there with Jacob. She'd been there in the camera shot with Jill and Jacob, however momentarily. His answer had still come to her, and when she got home, the front door was unlocked, and she found the house as dark and as cold as the flat she'd left earlier. It was 12:30, and she found Jacob slumped over the kitchen table with his headphones on. She took them off and asked him again, "What's the hottest time of day?" The answer, without verbal deadweight this time,
2 p.m.
His arms around her, and hers around him, knots and tangles they could only undo with eyes closed. "You're so warm." "About presents," she said. "Scrap it. Don't do this to anyone else."
"Agreed."
Jacob mentioned Alex once as they were comparing notes.
"I wish we had a picture at least,"
he said, and Jill knew what and whom he was referring to. She didn't agree, but neither did she contradict his wish. It was his own, after all.
A Brief History of the Homely Wench Society. From Willa Reed, stonecoldwilla at hotmail.com. To Dayong Sharif, Okinamaro 1993 at gmail.com. Date November 12, 2012, 1825. Subject: Join Us. Dear Dayong, among Cambridge University's many clubs, unions, academic forums, interest groups, activist cells, and societies, there's a sisterhood that emerged in direct opposition to a brotherhood. What this sisterhood lacks in numbers, it more than makes up for in lion-heartedness. The Homely Wench Society. The homely wenches can't be discussed without first noting that it was the Betancourt Society that necessitated the existence of precisely this type of organized and occasionally belligerent female presence at the university. The Betancourt Society has existed since 1875. The Betancourters are also known as the Franciscans because a man gets elected to this society on the basis of his having sufficient charisma to tame both bird and beast, just like Francis of Assisi. Each year at the end of Lent term, the society hosts a dinner at its headquarters, a pocket-sized palace off Magdalen Street that was left to the university by Hugh Betancourt, with the stipulation that it be used solely for Betancourt Society activities. If you've heard of the Betancourters, you may already know the following facts. No woman enters this building unless a member of the Betancourt Society has invited her. And no Betancourt Society member invites a woman into the building unless it's for this annual dinner of theirs. And getting invited to the dinner is dependent on your being considered exceptionally attractive. The Homely Wench Society has only existed since 1949. The women who were its first members had heard about the Betancourt Society and weren't that impressed with what they heard about the foundational principles of these so-called Franciscans. As for their annual dinner, strangely insecure of intelligent people to spend time patting each other on the backs for having social skills and getting pretty girls to have dinner with them. But people may spend their time as they please. No, the first Homely Wench Society members didn't have a problem with the Betancourt Society until Giles Rutherford, Betancourt Society President, 1949, PhD candidate in the Classics faculty, was writing a poem and got stuck. What he needed, he said, was to lay eyes on a girl whose very name conjured up the idea of ugliness the same way evoking Helen of Troy did for beauty. Luckily for Giles Rutherford's poem, the first wave of female cantabs working toward full degree certification were on hand to be ogled at. Rutherford sent his Betancourt Society brethren out into the university with this task. "Find me the homeliest wench in the university, my brothers. Search high and low. Do not rest until you've sketched her face and form and brought it to me. Combe Girton in particular. Something tells me you'll find her there." The Betancourters looked into every corner of Newnham and Girton and found many legends in the making. They compiled a list of Cambridge's homeliest wenches, a list which later fell into the hands of one of the women who had been invited to the Betancourt's annual dinner. This lady stole the list and sought out other women who'd accepted invitations to this dinner. Having gathered a number of them together, she showed the list of homely wenches around and asked, "Is this kind of list all right with us?" "No, it jolly well isn't," the others replied. "This is Cambridge, for goodness sake. If a person can't come here to think without these kind of annoyances, then where in this world can a person go?" They hesitated to involve the women whose names they'd seen on the list. Some of the Betancourt dinner invitees were friends with the homely witches and didn't want to cause any upset. Who wants to see their name on such a list? But in the end, they decided it was the only way to gather forces that would hold. Honouring delicacy over full disclosure only comes back to haunt you in the end. Moira Johnston, the first of the homely wenches to be informed of her place on the list, had to suspend a project she'd been working on in her spare time, the building of a bomb. She'd been looking for an answer to a question she had regarding the effects of a particular type of explosion, but the temptation to test her model on a bunch of fatheads was too strong. The others had similar responses, but soon settled on the simple but emphatic riposte. As they worked through this riposte, the Betancourt dinner invitees and the homeliest wenches discovered that, by and large, they liked each other and were interested in each other's work. They thereby declared themselves a society and gained the support of new members who hadn't been featured on either list. Nonetheless, the members of this new society dubbed themselves Homely Wenches One and All. The 1949 Betancourt Society dinner began pleasantly. Lots of champagne and gallantry, flirtation and the fluent discussion of ideas. They were served at table by waiters hired for the evening, and whenever a Betancourter disagreed with one of the guests, he made sure he mitigated his disagreement with a compliment on his opponent's dress, thereby reminding her what the true spirit of the evening was. Fun. At least it was for the boys. Until a great crashing sound came from the next room as the waiters were preparing to bring in the first course. Rutherford called out to the head waiter for the evening. The head waiter replied that something a bit odd had happened, but that service would be up and running again within a matter of moments. Waiting 5 minutes for a course was no great hardship. More compliments, more champagne. But when the head waiter was asked to explain the delay, he asked jocularly, "Do you believe in ghosts?" The lights in the kitchen had been switched off and then switched on again as the food was being plated, and then the waiters had heard footsteps in the next room, and then the portrait of Sir Hugh Betancourt in that very same room had fallen off the wall. The Betancourt boys laughed at this, but their guests turned pale and went off their food a bit. Who could say what might have happened to it when the lights had gone out? The Betancourt boys laughed even more. Even the cleverest woman can be silly. When the same sequence of events occurred between the first and second courses, footsteps and falling objects, this time all along the floor above the dining room, the Betancourters stopped laughing and looked for weapons that would assist them in apprehending intruders, spectral or otherwise. Their guests were one step ahead of them and had already had a firm hold on every object that could conceivably be used to stab or whack someone, including cutlery. "Do you want us to go and have a look?" asked Lizzie Holmes, first ever secretary of the Homely Witch Society. "No, no, you stay there. We'll take care of this," Betancourt President Rutherford said, adding a meaningful, "Won't we?" to his patently reluctant brethren. "Yes, yes, of course." The Betancourters had to go forth unarmed, since the frightened women refused to release even one set of ice tongs. Up the stairs they trooped, with no light to guide them. "We'll just wait in the kitchen," the waiter said, and they searched each room on the first floor and found no one there. When they filed back into the dining room, however, it was full of uninvited women, each of whom had taken seats emptied by the Betancourters and were tucking into the platefuls of food the Betancourters had temporarily abandoned. "Sit down, sit down. Join us," cried Moira Johnston, number one homeliest wench. The Betancourters looked to Rutherford to see how they should proceed. He decided the only sporting response was a good-natured one, so he and his brethren had another table brought into the room, had the waiters set places at it, and sat there and ate alongside all the wenches. Their plan had been just as you might have guessed by now. Earlier that evening, the last of the most attractive women to enter Betancourt headquarters had lingered at the door and let the first of the homeliest wenches into the building. As far as we know, the Betancourt Society never compiled another list of homely wenches. The Homely Winches Society flourished for a time, and then membership dwindled as ensuing generations of female cantabs saw little need to label themselves or to oppose the Betancourters, whose numbers remain steady. The activities of the Homely Winch Society mainly come under the banner of laughs, snacks, and coaching, but in response to advice from homely winches who've since graduated, the Society produces a termly journal, mostly for the purpose of posterity. We have no real readership other than ourselves, so if you want to join, our questions to you are, who are the homely winches of today? What makes you think you're one of us? Your answer is a key that will unlock worlds, yours, ours. So please make it as full and as bigarreux as it can be. Hope to hear from you soon. Willa Reed, Third Year History of Art, Keys. Ed Neong, Second Year, Nat Sai, Claire. Theo Ackner, Second Year History, Emma. Hildy Carlson, Third Year HSPS, Girton. Grania Malloy, Second Year Law, Peterhouse. Flor Delisa Castillo, First Year Comp Sci, Trinity. And Marie Adula, Third Year MML, Kings. It took Dayang Sharif, Second Year English Lit, Queens, days to think up an answer that was full and bigarreux. As soon as she read the email, she wanted in. Actually, as soon as she'd met Willa and Hildy on the train, she'd wanted in. But as with all groups, the membership hurdle wasn't so much to do with convincing the wenches that she was one of them, as it was to do with convincing herself. She looked the word bigarreux up and found that it meant both a medley of sundry colours running together and a discourse running oddly and fantastically from one matter to another. Medley of sundry colours running together made her think of her director of studies, Professor Chaudhry, saying, "I saw you with your Suffolk gang, Dayang, a colourful gang." She looked at him to check what he meant by colourful, and deciphered from his grin that other definitions included delightful and bloody well made my day. Di composed an answer that centred on the evening she'd met Hilda and Willa. She'd got on at King's Cross with Pepper, Luca and Thalia, all four of them covered in sweat and glitter. They'd had their Friday night out in London town, and now they were ready to get back to Di's room and crash. Hilda and Willa sat opposite them, sharing a red velvet cupcake. Di remembered trying not to fret about two whole girls afraid to eat a whole cupcake each. She didn't know them or their fears. She noticed Willa's long chestnut hair and Hilda's eyes, which were like big blue almonds. She'd never seen them before, but nodded at them, and they nodded back and continued their conversation, which seemed to be a comparison between medieval and modern logistics of kidnapping. Pepper and Luca were attempting to address Thalia's complaints about art school, and I was about to throw in her own tuppence worth when five boys, who looked about the same age as them, came swaying through the carriage singing rugby songs. Actually, Di didn't know anything about rugby, so they might not have been rugby songs per se, but the men definitely had rugby player builds. They stared as they passed Di and her friends. Di felt a twanging in her stomach when they walked back a few paces and their song died away. She could see them thinking about starting something, or saying something. If these boys said something, Luca would fight. And so would Pepper. And then what were Di and Thalia supposed to do? Broke a piece? Hardly. Di could punch. Her parents had only been called into school for emergency meetings about her twice, and both times had been about the punching. Not necessarily the fact of her having punched someone. No, it was the style of it. Di punched hard, and when she did so, she gave little to no warning. She punched veins. Aside from being disturbing to witness, the vein punching was extremely distressing for Di's target. The link between heart, lungs, and brain fizzed, and then seemed to snap. Then the target's limbs twitched haphazardly as they tried to recover some notion of gravity. Every now and again, Di's sister requested punching instruction from her, but this wasn't something Di could teach. She just knew how to do it. That was all. She thought it might be connected to anxiety and the need to be absolutely certain that it was shared. And she really didn't feel like punching anybody that night. She'd had a good time, and just wanted to keep having one. A couple of the rugby boys were black. They both caught Pepper's eyes, and all three looked apologetic for staring. But that didn't mean there wasn't going to be a fight. So Di, T, Pepper, and Luca tensed up. Di saw something interesting. Chestnut hair and blue almond eyes were no longer eating cake, and had tensed up too. Not the way you tense up when you're about to run away, but the way you tense up when you're not about to have any nonsense. And actually, looking around, Di saw that chestnut hair and blue almond eyes weren't the only ones. Others scattered across the carriage had become alert too, looking up from the screens of their phones, some even rolling their sleeves up.
"Jog on, lads,"
a barrel-chested man advised, and the boys seemed to reflect on numbers, then left and took their thoughts of starting something with them. When they'd gone, Chestnut Hair leaned across the table and said, "I'm Willa." Blue Almond Eyes introduced herself as Hilda and said, apropos of nothing, "When we were little, we had chicken pox together."
"Ah," Luca said sagely, "so you two are close."
Willa rubbed her nose. "Oh, but we didn't do it on purpose."
Willa was seriously posh. She tried to sound estuary, but couldn't go all the way. At the station, Hilda turned to them and asked, "Are you students here?" T, Pepper, and Luca talked over each other. "As if. Yeah, right." And all three pointed at Di. "There she is, Miss Establishment." "Please, just live your hate-filled lives happily, guys," Di said. Willa took Di's email address and said she'd be in touch. "We should all cotch sometime." Cotch? Pepper thought that sounded sexual. Luca said, "Maybe something to do with horse riding? That one blatantly rides horses." Thalia just giggled. The meeting on the train sort of answered the question of what made Di think she could be a homely wench, but it didn't answer the question of who a homely wench is. Second year was a year of conscientious study for Di. She couldn't have another exam result fiasco like last year. Too much time spent visiting Pepper at Oxford Brookes. So she could only return to her questions of wenchness after she'd done as much work toward her degree as was possible. All the reading and note-taking and following up on references that she could do in a day. Queens was in Di's blood, since it was her father's college, too. In his day, he'd flown thousands of miles specifically to enroll, whereas she'd come in from Suffolk. Her college library was at its best late at night. At night, the stained glass figures in the windows seemed to slumber, and the lamps on each desk gently rolled orange light along the floors until it formed one great globe that bounced along every twist and turn of the staircase to the upper levels. When she surveyed the entire scene, it seemed to be one that the stained glass figures were dreaming. And she was there too, living what was dreamed. She stretched, sighed. "Well, I'm a fanciful wench, but am I a homely one?" Her sister Aisha was gunning for Murray Edwards, their mother's college. Di hadn't sighed quietly enough. A few desks away, Hercules Dimitriou, first-year law, looked over at her and smiled. She looked away. She didn't think he was evil or anything, but he was a problem. The issue was all hers for fancying him, even though he'd already been elected to the Betancourt Society. The boy was tall and well-built and had wavy hair, excellent teeth, and unshakable equilibrium. Up close, you saw smatterings of acne, but that was no comfort. His skin tone lent him enough ethnic ambiguity for small children whose parents had a taste for vintage Disney to run up to him and ask, "Are you Aladdin?" He'd flash them a dazzling smile and answer, "Nah, I'm Hercules." Hercules of Stockwell. So full of himself. This was not an attraction that Di could ever confess to anybody. Hercules talked to her, though. He'd say, "See you in the bar, yeah?" as he and his friends walked past her and her friends. Then Mike or Dara or Jiro would turn to her and say things like, "So will you see him in the bar? Or his bed, for that matter?" Horrible. When Hercules Dimitriou spoke to Di, her heart beat loudly and her loins acted as if they didn't know what the rest of her knew about him. What was he after? Di didn't actually think she was unattractive. Her appearance was mostly passable, and sometimes even exceeded that. Two things that were not in her favor were her spectacles, which often led people, including herself, to incorrectly anticipate a sexy librarian effect. You know, the glasses come off, the hair tumbles down, and there she is. Nope, she had unreasonably large feet, too. She'd never walk on moonbeams. Why would the perfectly proportioned Hercules Dimitriou keep trying to befriend her? It made no sense. Unless the slimy Betancourters were compiling another list, after all. The young hero was still looking over. Di took her glasses off, cleaned them, put them back on, and then typed a couple of paragraphs. Who is a homely wench? Is a girl who exhaustively screens every man her mother contemplates seeing a homely wench. Leaving these things to Aisha meant just letting it all go to hell.
How about a girl who sometimes finds it easier to talk to her dad's boyfriend than she does to her dad? What manner of wench is she? Dai's dad still fasted at Ramadan, even though he didn't go to mosque anymore, and from time to time he flared up at signs of Dai and Aisha's secular disrespect, which he was almost sure they were learning from their mum. They weren't. If anything, they were learning it from Dad's boyfriend, Anton. But apart from being less hung up on manners, Anton was less sensitive than Dad. Dai had once mentioned being envious of her friend Zoe for having two mums. She'd been talking about the miracle of having two mums who were both so cool, but her dad had taken her words to mean that she didn't want all the family she had, and he'd looked so crestfallen that she'd spent ages explaining her original comment and making it sound even more dismissive of him and Anton until he'd had to laugh. A girl at the desk next to Hercules, Lakmini, Dai thought her name was, wrote him a note. Must have been a hot note, because he fanned himself with it. But Miss Dayang Sharif couldn't have cared less what the note said. No way. Who are the homely wenches of today? She wrote about her first boyfriend, Michael, her first and only boyfriend to date. She'd been in love with him, and they broke up, but the love didn't. In fact, the love got, not truer, just better. Their friend Maisie's parents were away on the same weekend as the Eurovision Song Contest Grand Final. So Maisie opened up her house to all my Eurovision bitches, which turned out to be not that many. Just Maisie, Dai, and Aisha, until Michael showed up, with two friends, Luca and Thalia. A taxi pulled up outside of Maisie's house, and Michael, Luca, and Thalia got out, the three of them dressed in silk sheaths. Real heavy silk. Maisie rushed to the front door. What? Who are they? Are the Supremes really about to come in right now? I must have saved a nation in a past life. It took a couple of hours to get around to talking to Thalia and Luca. She only had eyes for Michael. For the first time she was seeing that he had everything she coveted from pre-Technicolor Hollywood. Hip-swinging walk, lips that tell cruel lies and sweet truths with a single smile, eyelashes that touch outer space. If Betty Davis and Rita Hayworth had had a Caribbean love child, that child would be Michael, just as he was that night. They hugged for a long time, and later they talked on the balcony outside. "Thank God for the internet," he said. "I wouldn't have found Luca and tea without it. All sorts of nutters out there, but mine found me." He settled on the name Pepper. Dai remembered the rest of that night in stop motion. Galloping, shimmying, the speakers turned up so loud that the singing shook the air, and the beat of the music was like being knocked on the head. The backbeat was a hammock you fell into. Ring-a-ring-a-rosies, pan flutes, trumpets and yodeling. Dai was holding hands with Luca, who held hands with Aisha, who held hands with Maisie, who held hands with Pepper, who held hands with her, dancing around in a circle with bags and coats stacked in the center, cheering for the countries whose stage performances made the most effort or projected the most bizarre aura. Luca and Thalia became Dai's too. "For life, yeah? Not just for Eurovision." Thalia didn't even like Eurovision. She said she'd come along to meet Dai. "This one's always going on about you," she said, gesturing toward Pepper. Dai's stepdad Anton, who'd had trouble remembering Michael's name, hailed Pepper with joy, even as he teased Dai about the times she'd said Michael was the one. Dai just shrugged. Pepper wasn't always on the surface, but whether she was with Pepper as Pepper or Pepper as Michael, Dai had found the one she'd always be young with, eating cornettos on roller coasters, forever honing their ability to combine screams with ice cream. So, who is a homely wench? Dai wrote about Luca, muscular and much-pierced Luca, and how that first Eurovision they spent together, his hair was the same shade of pastel mint as the dress he wore. He and Thalia were a bit older in their early 20s. By day, he sold high fashion pieces. "Everyone wants to fly away from here, but not everyone can make their own wings. So they buy them from me."
By night, he was an unstoppable bon vivant, deciding what kind of buzz was right for that night, and mixing the pharmaceutical cocktail that had the least torturous hangover attached. He'd had nights so rough he could hardly believe he was still alive. But this can't be the afterlife. Ugh, it can't be. Luca laughs long and loud, and his body shakes as he does so. He's better at forgetting than forgiving. He says this is the only thing about him that scares him. Speaking of him, Di's father says, "So vulnerable," at the same time as her stepdad says, "Brazen." Neither is quite right. When Luca was younger, he got kicked out of his parents' house for a while. They'd hoped it'd make him less brazen, but it didn't. He stayed with friends and got brasher, and when he came home, it was like he took his family back into his heart, rather than the other way around. Di knew Pepper and Luca were together. She'd also heard that Luca liked to pursue straight men. Delia referred to this tendency as Luca's danger sport. Pepper said Luca'd be fine. He's got us. Oh, and Thalia. Di had to talk about tea. Thalia's aesthetic was the most civilian. Pepper had learned the most from her YouTube makeup tutorials, and Thalia was her full-time name. She was composed, reserved. She lived with an older man none of her friends had met. The only reason her friends even knew about the older man was because of a week when T had been ecstatic because she'd sold 5 triptychs and received a really considered, insightful note about them from the buyer. But then she found out the buyer was her boyfriend, so she was furious for a couple of days, and then the fury mingled with elation again. Luca argued that the boyfriend was merely investing in an artist who'd be famous one day. And whenever Thalia heard this, she said, "Care," to indicate that she didn't. Thalia painted scenes into mirrors, dramatic, televisual, 2 shots from stories that had only ever been screened in Thalia's mind. Her mirror paintings left gaps where the facial features of the characters would normally be, so that your face could more easily become theirs. T's brushstrokes are thin, translucent, and mercurial in their placement. They swirl into one another. Her colors are white and silver. Around the images, Thalia paints a few words from the script, an alphabet frame. Di's favorite was a voiceover. "The poison taster is feeling a bit ill. He's well paid, but he hates his master so much that today, the day he finally tasted poison, he's eaten a lot and is managing to keep a normal expression on his face until his master has eaten at least as much as he has. Eat heartily, boss. Don't stop now." Who's a homely wench? Luca is, and Di is, and so are Pepper and Thalia and Hilda and Willa, and anyone who is not just content to accept an invitation, but wants more people to join the party. More and more and more. Di can just hear Pepper and Luca climbing up onto a tabletop at such a party and screaming out. They'd have to scream through megaphones, as she's envisioning a gathering that'd fill Rome's Colosseum many times over. "Hello, everyone! It's great to see you all, you homely beasts and wenches!" Send. The homely wenches have no fixed headquarters, and all the members agree that this keeps them humble, relying as they do on the soft furnishings and snack-based offerings on whichever member is host to wench meetings for the month. February was Di's month for hosting meetings, and this particular meeting had been called to discuss articles for the Lent term edition of The Wench. There were to be 2 interviews, one with a bank robber who'd turned down a place at Cambridge and now half regretted it. Marie was covering that story. She had a feeling for bittersweet regret and mercenary women. The other interview was with Myrna Semyonova, author of a novel, Sob Story, which she'd written to make her girlfriend laugh, consisting as it does of a long, whiskey-soaked celebration of all the mistakes 2 male poets, one young, one middle-aged, had made and were making in their lives. The narrator of the novel was the bar the 2 poets drank at, and since Semyonova had published the book under the pen name Reb Jones, she was hailed as the new Bukowski. Willa was covering that, and her reaction to sob stories being taken so seriously was the same as that of Semyonova's girlfriend. It made the joke twice as funny. Ed was working on a piece about hierarchies of knowledge for female love interests in the early issues of her favorite comic books. How very odd it must be to operate within a story where you're capable, courageous, droll, at the top of your field professionally, and yet somehow still not permitted the brains to perceive that the man you see or work with every day is exactly the same person as the superhero who saves your life at night. Seems like someone behind the scenes clinging to the idea that the woman whose attention you can't get just can't see the real you. No? Di looked from face to face. Marie might get on with Thalia. They both favored grave formality and never letting a single hair fall out of place. Though Marie's Zaire French accent and her tendency to wear jackets over her shoulders without putting her arms in the sleeves gave her attitude more impact than Thalia's. The society was too small to have a leader, but if they'd had one, Marie would have been it. Sometimes when Marie and Willa spoke together in French, glancing around as they did so, Di felt that they were disparaging her mode of dress. But Ed had reassured her that that was just how people who could only speak English naturally responded to fluent French speakers. Ed, named after Edwina Curie, was much easier to get to know. You could chat to her about anything. If she didn't understand a reference you made, she just said so. Rare, very rare for anyone Di had met at Cambridge to admit to gaps in their understanding. But Ed would ask to hear more. This puckish, boyish young woman was black like Marie, and a Londoner like Willa. But as she put it herself, a different kind of black, and a different kind of London. It was hard to picture a time, place, or opportunity other than university and the homely wench society for the likes of Ed, Willa, and Marie to find out that they really got on. For one thing, all three had a tendency to assume that everybody else was joking all the time and responded accordingly. Willa with breezy levity, Marie with frank disappointment, Ed with various micro-expressions, semi-smiles, really, that made you want to laugh too, even if you really did mean what you just said. Theo and Hilda, on the other hand, didn't think anybody was joking about anything unless they were explicitly told so. Theodora Ackner, Nebraska's finest, was still disconcerted by Europe's ghosts. Hilda, Ed, and Grania could no longer hear them, but the ghosts seemed to wake up again around Theo, since she actively listened for them. Lisbon, Paris, and Vienna were tough places for her, beauties clotted with blood. Hilda refused to accompany Theo to Oslo. "About a quarter of my family lives there, Theodora. Let me know these things in my own way." And then there was Grania Malloy, who had lobbied to be recorded in the annals of the homely wench society as the irrepressible Grania Malloy. Unsuccessfully, since, as Hilda pointed out, sometimes you are repressible, though. While Grania did truly lose her temper several times a day, that frenetic energy of hers occasionally served to obscure another trait, the cool and calculated collection of incriminating anecdotes. The newest homely wench was half in love with every single one of her fellow wenches. But she wasn't sure what she, Dayoung, brought to the mix. She'd been a member for just over 3 months and hadn't had an idea for an article or a group activity yet. She snapped the group photos so she wouldn't have to see physical proof of her being odd man out. Maybe she could do something toward recruitment. A few of her friends from college and faculty had seemed interested when she mentioned the wenches. Fleur de Lisa, the youngest wench, their first year, arrived late, as expected. "Afternoon, ladies!" She grabbed a handful of biscuits and flopped down onto Di's bed. She'd been growing out a side mohawk since the summer, so her front hair was still much longer than it was at the back. Her clothes were crumpled and she clearly slept without removing her eyeliner. Di had barely noted this before Fleur announced that she had a tale of shame to tell, but also a tale of possibility. "Go," Theo commanded from the window seat. She'd arranged Di's curtains about her so that they resembled a voluminous toga. "Okay, first of all, you're not allowed to judge me." "We're all friends here," Marie said sternly. Fleur de Lisa revealed that a member of the Betancourt Society was into Yorkshire Filipinas. "Or maybe just into this," she pointed at herself. "Oh, God," Grania shouted.
Oh, God, Flordelisa, what did you do? Di waited to hear about Flora and Hercules. She felt a bit sick, but that was just obstructed emotion, a sensation the Dayang Sharifs of this world know all too well. Spring was definitely in the air, even as early as February. Everyone except Di was in some sort of romantic relationship. Marie with the townie who rode a motorbike, Willa with a curator at the Fitzwilliam, Theo with a guide who led tours of Dickensian London, Ed and Grania with each other, and now Flordelisa with her Betancourt boy. Di's only hope was that Hercules Demetrio would come out of the story sounding so greasy that Di's physical response to his proximity would be mercifully dulled forever. The other day she passed him and a few other boys she suspected were Betancourters on King's Parade, apparently conducting a survey that involved soliciting the opinions of women. More like ranking them, she muttered, and Hercules had smiled at her and said, "Sorry, what was that?"
"Nothing, hello."
"Hi, listen, do you want to..."
"Sorry, I can't, bye."
Floor wasn't talking about Hercules, but about a third year at a college named Barney Chaskell, a boy she hadn't pegged for a Betancourter because...
"Well, he's sort of low-key and makes fun of his own obsession with conspiracy theories, and he's sweet."
"Sweet!" came at her from every corner of the room. Di asked it loudest, more with curiosity than incredulity. Hilda said, "Floor, aren't you going too far?"
"Look, on the way over, I actually thought about presenting all this as if I'd seduced him on purpose to get info. But the truth is, I didn't know Chaskell was a Betancourter until this morning. I said I had to run to a wench meeting, and he was like, 'Surely not the homely wenches.' And I was like, 'Yeah, the very same.' And then he went on, 'How funny, I'm a Betancourter.'"
"How funny? This Barney Chaskell thinks our decades of enmity are just a bit of fun?" Theo wondered aloud.
"Floor," Marie said in sepulchral tones, "so far, this is the tale of our enemies evolving into ever more superficial, pleasing forms. You mentioned that this was also a tale of possibility."
"Flordelisa, if there's a twist, introduce it now, or there might be beats in store for you," Ed added.
But Floor did have something good for them after all. She'd followed Barney Chaskell to Betancourt Society headquarters and had seen him punch in the code that let him into the building. That was why she was late. She'd seen the sequence, but not its exact components. So she'd cased the joint, observed that the Betancourters left through another door, and gave herself three chances to repeat the code Barney had punched in.
"Babe," Willa said, "B-A-B-E. Third time lucky?"
Floor laughed and said,
"Second."
Grania and Willa hooted and jumped on her, but Hilda, Ed, and Theo were unmoved.
"There's no need for us to enter Betancourt premises," Hilda declared.
Theo agreed. The wenches made the ultimate gesture years ago.
"No, come on, come on. We've got this, so it'd basically be folly and sin not to use it," Grania said.
But Ed backed up Hilda and Theo.
"Yeah, it'd be nice to fuck with the Betancourters' heads a bit more, but I'd rather we move on, concentrate on building ourselves up. We need more pieces for the wench. Weren't we just about to hear an idea from you, Di?"
"I think we should go in," Di said.
Everybody went quiet, but her words were mainly for Marie, who hadn't expressed an opinion either way.
"I think we should go in and do a book swap."
"A book swap?" Marie echoed.
"Yup. I'm betting the Betancourters don't have many, or maybe even any, books by female authors on the bookshelves. And speaking collectively, we don't have that many male authors on our own shelves."
"Yes, but that's personal preference and our desire to honour what's ours, Di," Hilda said.
"I know," said Di, "and I do, but I want to read everything. When it comes to books and who can put things in them and get things out of them, it's all ours. And all theirs, too. So we go in, see what books they have, take a few, and replace them with a few of ours."
"No muss, no fuss," Theo said grudgingly.
"I devoted to trash the place, but I don't care what we do as long as we do something," Willa said. "I suppose that would have wrecked Floor's budding romance, though."
Floor covered her face, but didn't deny being keen on Barney Chaskell.
Marie spoke up. I do want to do something. I have been waiting for a chance to do something to the Bettencourt Society ever since a Bettencourter used me as a human shield on my very first Thursday at this university. She stared out of Di's window and into the very moment of the incident. Her face was transfigured with wrath. Another guy was chasing him, Grania whispered to Ed and Floor. He said he never thought the other guy would hit a girl. So I am in favor of Dayang's proposal, Marie concluded. All others in favor of Dayang's proposal, raise your hands. Di raised her hand, as did Floor, Grania, Willa, and Theo. Theo said she was only coming along to make sure they did it right. Di found Hercules Demetrius sitting at her usual desk in the library. Rather than talk to him, she went to his usual desk, which was unoccupied, and set up her laptop there. He looked over at her three times. She looked over at him once, just once, and he came over. Ugh, was it that pitifully obvious? He drew a chair up to her desk and leaned on the corner of it. Everything about him was dark, delicious, fluid, that gaze especially. If she moved her arm just a little, it'd touch his. There was an envelope in his hand. Listen, I heard you like John Waters, he said. I do, she said. So? His sister ran a cinema in Stockwell. He described it as pocket-sized. Big Sis had given Hercules two tickets for a screening of Female Trouble and... No.
Are you sure?
Are you finding it hard to believe that a girl wouldn't want to go and see a film with someone as amazing as you? He drew back, but didn't retreat. Instead, he subjected her to a deeper look. The first to break the gaze would lose, so she didn't blink. I was just finding it hard to believe that a John Waters fan wouldn't want a ticket to Female Trouble, he said, then dropped his gaze, laughing a little. Here, take two. He put the envelope down in front of her and went back to his desk. Then he came back.
Dayang, can I ask you something?
Oh, my God. If you must.
Why did you come here?
Here?
Here to this university?
She thought of Professor Chaudhry, one of the professors who'd interviewed her, and how he'd said he liked the connections he could see her making in her mind, and the way that she tried to tend them so that they thrived. Nobody had ever said anything like that to her before. Usually it was, "Aren't you ever thinking things die?" But a gardener growing thoughts. She liked that. Hercules, tired of waiting for Di to answer him.
"Didn't you want to see who else was here?" he asked. "I know that's part of the reason why I came. It's the reason why I go to most parties."
Parties? She couldn't stop herself from smiling. "Okay, same."
"So," he said, "I'm here, you're here. You find me off-putting at the moment, but why don't you try treating me like a person? You might like me."
"Bettencourter," she said. His eyebrows shot up, and he said,
"Ah."
Not an enlightened ah. If anything, he was more puzzled. "It's Lent term. Aren't you supposed to be looking for someone to bring to that dinner of yours?" The penny dropped.
"You're a homely wench, aren't you?"
"And proud." He gathered up his things and left the library, shaking his head and muttering something she didn't catch. Di took the cinema tickets out of the envelope and texted the date on them to Pepper. "Female Trouble in London? Yes or yes?"
Yes!
The Bettencourters were well-read in various directions. That's what their bookshelves said about them anyway. Plenty of stimulating-looking books, less than 10% of which were authored by women. The substitutions were made by torchlight, as nobody thought it was a good idea to switch on the house lights at 4 a.m. and risk some passing Bettencourter coming round to see if any of his brethren was up for another drink. The keys to the rooms of the house were on a hook beside the light switch in the entrance hall, so the girls peeped into the Bettencourt Society drinks cabinet, too. It was more of a walk-in closet than a drinks cabinet, a closet vertically stocked with hard liquor from floor to ceiling. There were even little ladders for more convenient perusal. Di had never seen anything like it. Floor, Di, Willa, Marie, and Theo unloaded their rucksacks and filled them again with books from the Bettencourt shelves.
Not having read any of the books she was taking, Dai made her exchanges based on thoughts the titles or authors' names set in motion. She exchanged 2 Edith Wharton novels for 2 Henry James novels, Lucia Berlin's short stories for John Cheever's, Elaine Dundy's The Dud Avocado,